Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's podcast, Monday podcast, is brought to you again by our friends at 8 Sleep. We'll have more information about that a little bit later, and you can subscribe to us. All the places where they have high-quality podcasts, or even low-quality or medium-quality podcasts. Our guest today is the author of the number one piece of the Bulwark today about Katie Hopkins. So Molly Jong-Fast joins us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so you were recently in Nantucket.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Wait, do you know where I'm going with this? Well, you're laughing.
No, well, I suspect, yes, potentially.
Okay, so you were in, and there's a very, very interesting story that you tell about sunscreen and going to Nantucket and destroying your computer and everything, which we're not going to get into. But when you mentioned Nantucket being a Midwesterner, I just started thinking of limericks involving Nantucket. And,
yes.
and a certain phrase that you do get very close to using in this piece about Katie Hopkins. So
continue.
Well, I'm just saying that we can talk about this, but one of my goals for this week is to avoid getting the explicit ratings on iTunes. Do you know what I'm saying here?
I've gotten that before.
Yeah. So no limericks involving Nantucket.
Okay.
And then the fact that you write about Katie Hopkins. Now, like, you know, if we do get the explicit rating, if you can't help it, I mean, it's a podcast. That, you know, I spent 20 years doing conservative talk radio.
Right.
And being on AM radio, the you know, one of the things that you always in the back of your mind thinking, I drop one F-bomb and I'm really in trouble. I could get fired for an F-bomb, or we could have an FCC fine for an F-bomb or something. And so it really is kind of this liberating thing. You're on a podcast. You can just drop F-bombs like crazy.
Wait, we just had a conversation where you said, please don't, let's try not to curse.
Well,
I'm mixed messages.
There are mixed messages, but you've heard of a guy named Rick Wilson, right?
Yeah, I've heard of him, yeah.
Oh, okay, well, he comes on. We've carved out a little space for him.
Right.
Rick and I are in an F-bomb okay zone.
Okay.
Okay, now you're feeling discriminated against here because...
No, he's from Florida. It's different rules in Florida.
Okay, that's the story, and I am sticking to it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So before we get into this weekend, speaking of... Actually, it has nothing to do with Florida. I have no idea what the segue is, but I just wanted to talk about this. I got this bizarre racist thing on one of my comment sections. I don't know if you saw it on Twitter. I put it out. A guy wrote to me, and he dropped a few F-bombs. This is actually one of my favorite stories of the week. So he writes this comment to me. Hold on, you know, and he leaves his name, which you can find on social media. He sent it to me from his work email address. You know, you are not a conservative! ! You stay on that vermin MSNBC channel and agree with these communists. Name a country run by Mexicans or blacks that is not a complete disgusting mess. You homos will get your wish, and the United States will become Mexico. If you want these law-breaking brown people in this country, why don't you invite a family of them to your home? If not, shut the F up. Pray you liberal bastards get what you want, then there will be civil war in this country. Again, I'm effing ready. You notice I just did the effing.
Right.
So,
that was good.
So he later then writes back denying that it was him. And, you know, that he said, this wasn't me, except the punctuation is exactly the same. He doesn't make a space, you know, after the thing. But here's the real thing. Here's the real tell. When I tweeted it out, it just says the email address, name, email address, subject, the comment, and then the thing. But it doesn't say where it came from. And it turns out that he had posted this on a comment link on a very obscure website that I have called Conservative Contrarian that I'm not embarrassed to admit is like read by almost no one.
Okay.
So it's a very obscure place. And so what I did a screenshot of it, but I did not include, I did not say this comes from the comment section of the Contrarian Conservative.
Right.
There's no way that anyone would know that. So if somebody wants to get in touch with me, there's lots of ways. There's email, right? There's Twitter. There's all kinds of ways of getting in touch. But when this guy writes back, it's not me. That's not me. I was hacked. My phone was at my neighbor's. He puts the comment in the same place, in the comment link of this obscure website that no one on earth would know was the first one. This guy is so profoundly dumb as well as bigoted. And the fact that he used his business email account. So anyway, I don't know how that is.
That's pretty impressive. I once got a death threat on LinkedIn.
Okay. On LinkedIn.
I said, I don't think that's what LinkedIn is for.
So speaking of the bigots out there, and this is one of the experiences that we are in, I think, now, is that I feel it's like we peeled off some scab and, you know, or what's a better analogy? You know, you open something up and all these bugs crawl out and going, okay, were they there all along? I mean, what is this? And your piece is about, which we're finally getting to here, Katie Hopkins, a British troll who is routinely tweeted by the president of the United States. So let's just, you know, of all of the things to be depressed about today, the fact that the president of the United States is tweeting out insane conspiracy theories about the Jeffrey Epstein killing, suggesting that it was the Clintons who murdered him. This is the president of the freaking United States. And we're all like, okay, well, that's just Donald Trump. I mean, don't presidents do this on a regular basis? Wasn't Richard Nixon constantly accusing Lyndon Johnson of murdering John F. Kennedy? Okay, so tell me who, let's walk through. Who is Katie Hopkins?
So, I mean, she's sort of irrelevant. She was on one of the British Apprentice. She became a sort of, you know, what's interesting to me, and I remember really seeing this when I was in England and have published books there. It's pretty easy to get famous in England because there just aren't that many people and there's a lot of media. It's really true. I mean, there are tons of morning shows. There are tons of radio shows. The British like read a lot of books. They read a lot of newspapers. They have like a million newspapers. I mean, if you think about how many newspapers they have for such a small country, they have a million newspapers. They're much more involved in their media. So it's not that hard to get famous in England. And a lot of really stupid people are famous there. Like, you know, worse there. I mean, even stupider.
Okay.
And so, well, though, I don't know, maybe the same, but
they think Benny Hill is funny.
That's true. But they have
okay, but also they gave us Monty Python. So this is the paradox of the Brits, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But they have some pretty stupid people, but she was on The Apprentice for one season and she basically was a sort of she had gone to military, the sort of fancy military schools, like the one Prince Harry went to, Sandhurst. And she had very, very, very racist views. And she had kids, and she also, you know, there's all sorts of weird adultery things in her history. But ultimately, I would say she sort of became, you know, UK famous. And she got she had a column at The Sun, which is a Murdoch paper and is as you know, pretty trashy. And then she went, she sort of got promoted to the Daily Mail. And then she wrote a column about how she compared these African migrants coming over because they're being persecuted and, you know, murdered to cockroaches. And that was how she ended up losing her job at the Daily Mail. She was too racist for the Daily Mail.
Ooh. Okay. Let me just read what you wrote here. But Katie Hopkins isn't a little racist. She isn't even mildly racist. She is real effing racist. Katie Hopkins is so racist that she got fired by a British tabloid. So that's pretty hard to be.
Yeah. I mean, Daily Mail is historically very racist. So that is pretty impressive. I also think that ultimately she herself, you know, I got a lot of comments today on Twitter, people saying don't elevate her. And I don't think that it's so much. I mean, I agree. You know, it's that old Milo thing. Like, do you not talk, you know, if you deplatform them? I would say this. I think with Katie Hopkins, it's important to know what the president is doing here, because I think it's meaningful. And what he's doing is he's found someone that he has that is really exact, like really, 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 really bad and racist and evil. And he's sort of been retweeting her as a way to kind of tell his base, it's all good. You know, I'm still with you.
Well, okay, so a couple things. First of all, there's a lot more stuff. I mean, Katie Hopkins, you know, in Britain, people are really rolling their eyes at this, that Donald Trump keeps retweeting her because she's so far out there, and she really is a real effing racist, who's talked about we need she uses the term final solution to the Muslim problem. Not terribly subtle. I saw the tweets, saying, "Well, why are you providing her the platform?" Which I think totally misses the point, because the president of the United States, the quote unquote leader of the free world, is embracing this woman, is elevating her, is retweeting her at a time when we're having this debate about, hey, what is the role of the president of the United States in encouraging white nationalism? Is it possibly that the president is enabling white nationalism? And here you have the president of the United States in broad daylight, who is continuing to retweet this woman, who is not, it's not a close call. It is not subtle whatsoever what she's doing. So I don't think it is, quote unquote, elevating her to talk about this, because that's done. Right. That's completely there.
Well, the president is giving her a platform, which
the president of the United States. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, we have this debate. You know, I see the Hugh Hewitt has now weighed in saying, oh, the president's not a racist.
Well, can you explain to me Hugh Hewitt?
Do you want me to?
Yeah.
Really?
You don't have to.
Be careful what you ask for.
I mean, he's sort of like mini Rush Limbaugh?
No, actually, he's in some ways, because he's actually smarter than Rush Limbaugh in a certain way. But he's just simply decided that he's going to be a champion and a defender of Trump and Trumpism. And here's somebody who was anti-Trump during the campaign, and like so many others, has made their peace with this and used their considerable talents in order to engage in the, you know, pretzeling logic of saying that, you know, A is not A and B is not B. I think what's worse for Hugh Hewitt is that he continues to blurb, you know, this bigoted bilge, you know, this racist, violent porn that's, novels that we wrote about on the Bulwark. But, you know, see, this is the problem that we're at right now, where Trump's behavior is so extreme when it comes to this. And you would think that, you know, if people really are concerned about the future of the conservative movement, and I know you're a progressive,
right,
then shouldn't their agenda be to tell the president, you must stop doing this. You must stop pouring this arsenic over our heads. You must stop trafficking in this kind of language. Instead, they've made the political and ultimately the moral decision to say, yeah, okay, you know, you're doing this, and we're going to defend it. We're going to rationalize it. We're going to gaslight the country and say, this doesn't really mean what it says it means.
Right.
Okay, so Molly, two years ago, this is an anniversary. 2 years ago, Ted, 2 years ago, we had the Charlottesville riots and the death of a young woman at the hands of white nationalists.
Yeah. And it's so funny, because if you think about it, so little it's like we're in this strange time where have things changed? I think they've gotten much worse.
Well, and I think they got worse because there was a moment, you might recall, and there have been so many of these moments, where when the president said, you know, well, there's guilt on both sides and some very fine people. And
that's right.
By the way, there's this cottage industry on the right saying that he didn't really say those things. And it's,
I know. Why is that?
Well, because he must be defended at all costs, because everything right. So he must provide these defenses. So we're seeing those defenses. But he did those things. And there was this, oh, my goodness, this is really awful. You had people like Gary Cohn, you know, the economics advisor.
Right.
Like, resign?
He did stay on,
of
course.
Was real horror about this, and yet his numbers didn't really move. I think he had a little blip down, but ultimately it didn't matter. So this whole nothing matters meme was really reinforced. And I think he realized that that unlike almost any other politician in the history of the country, certainly any other president, he was really immunized against a quote-unquote gaffe like that. And rather than touching the hot stove, and this is how we learn not to do stupid things, right?
Right.
We touch the hot stove, we pour sunscreen onto our, you know, keyboards. Computer. And we realize, don't do that again. That's just terrible.
I mean, I think it's interesting to me when you see that video. I was writing about that this weekend, that he was off the cuff Trump, you know, Twitter Trump, when he was talking about Charlottesville. And, you know, when he said, I know it and you know it, too. And you know, we got very excited defending Charlottesville, the good people on both sides and the horrible leftists who caused, you know, and it was so interesting. But then if you look at teleprompter Trump, who a week ago when he was on TV talking about El Paso, and he read those words, you remember he read those words and he looked like a hostage. And it's just so interesting to me. You know, real Trump and like teleprompter Trump are just so different. And I always feel like he's trying to tell his base, you know, don't worry, I'm just saying this PC, you know, it's not PC. I mean, it's just the bare minimum, but I'm just saying it because they're making me.
I just am amazed that there's anyone at all who takes teleprompter Trump seriously as opposed to Twitter Trump or Rally Trump or real Trump. Because, I mean, there's no question which is the real Donald Trump. This is not a mystery. This is not a hard one. Or to see what he gets excited about. I mean, we, you know, had there been if it had been an Islamic terrorist who had committed the acts in El Paso or Dayton, can imagine, you know exactly what Donald Trump would say, how he would behave, what he would do, the level of passion, level of involvement, and then compare it to the hostage video where he's reading from the teleprompter. And yet, maybe because the bar is so low, I mean, I was watching some of the commentators on television going, well, he said the words. He spoke the words. These are the healing words. I think it was even Karl Rove said, you know, let's look at what the president said. You know, the president said these words, which are, I mean, really? Are we really supposed to believe this?
The problem is he so often doesn't say the words. Like, he so often just, I mean, with Charlottesville, he just said, well, there was fault on both sides, you know. So the fact that he even managed, I mean, the bar is so low, but we've also seen him do the wrong thing numerous times.
Throw us a bone. Give us something to work with. And that's the way I felt with some of the people who are in the denialism, you know, who are denying that he is really, you know, has a some sort of responsibility for the uptick of white nationalist terrorism. Is like, give us a bone and we can work with this, but you have to give it to us in this particular way. Now, let me push back a little bit on because we have to disagree about something, don't we, Molly?
Right. Yes.
Since you're a screaming socialist lefty.
That's right, a socialist, yeah.
Because you hate America?
Yeah, pretty much.
Who do you hate more, God or America?
It's very close. But,
okay, it depends which day it is.
Yeah, exactly.
So you are theorizing that he's sort of sending the signal to his this dog whistle, the signal to his base. But who is his base? I mean, don't you have to break that down? So you have 40% of Americans who are going, yeah, we're okay with this guy.
Right.
But of that 40%, you know, 40% of Americans are not white nationalists, are they?
No.
So what percent? See, you know, so I mean, there's this really small group, like the guy that, you know, the guy that stupidly sent me the comment.
Guy.
And by the way, I think he's going to probably lose his job as a result of this. But you know, sent me the comment about the brown people. I mean, I really wrestle with this. What percentage of Americans does that represent? So I mean, I kind of break it down to, you have your hardcore racists, which is a relatively small percentage. But then you have
15%.
I don't know. Then you have the adjacent folks who are not, but who are okay with it.
Yeah.
And who kind of look over their shoulder and say, okay, is that acceptable to me? Because I think there's a lot of Americans, you know, Americans are not either racist or not racist. They're not even good or evil, right? We're all a mix of everything. And it's sort of like, you know, when you see people modeling behavior, people who could otherwise go a completely different direction, then so, okay, well, maybe that is the problem. Maybe, you know, all these Mexican rapists are coming here for our jobs and for our women and everything. And so I don't know, you know, which base he's sending that signal to.
I mean, I think that that Trump feels, and I could be wrong, but this is just a guess, that Twitter Trump is the one that the base loves. And so I don't know that he can parse out what elements of Twitter Trump the base likes. So I think he just assumes that they like the crazy racist stuff. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if it's because they're crazy racist or because they just like, they just, I mean, look, I personally, I think if you're in on Trumpism, you're a racist. That's just my personal opinion. But because, I mean, just, that's just my feeling. That's my, in my heart. But I do think there are people who respond to crazy racist Grandpa Trump in a positive way. And he knows that. And so he's just trying to keep that going. And I think that is the issue there. Like, I don't know that he's so sophisticated about, I think he just wants people to know that even if he can get up there, even if he occasionally gets up there and says what people want him to say, what the mainstream culture wants him to say, he's still really Twitter Trump to his face.
So here's the, here's, I think, the danger among his critics, and which is that whatever Donald Trump, and I've answered this before, I mean, I don't think he's got great strategic thought, but he does have this reptilian cunning. And one of the things that he really wants Democrats to do is to not simply attack him, but to attack his supporters. So the danger is when you say that anybody that's in favor of Trumpism, was that mean, and votes for Donald Trump is a racist, because then they weaponize that. That becomes the deplorable comment. Then what you've done is they're not attacking me. They're attacking you. They hate you. They despise you. And they think you're all racist. And that is dangerous. But it is becoming more and more difficult, because clearly the tolerance of this then becomes itself a, it carries moral weight, I think. You know,
I think that they will use that, but I think that, you know, in a funny way, Mayor Pete had it right. You know, he said they're going to call us Democrats crazy socialists no matter what we do. So we should just pick policies we like. And I do think he's right about that. You know, there's Republican, you know, this Trump Republican Party has lowered the bar. I must stand up for my values. You know, I can't go along with it. And they're lowering the discourse in a way to try to drag the rest of us with them.
Yeah, but, you know, let me tell you where, and I actually like Mayor Pete, and you and I have talked about this before, but I think there's a danger in what he's saying there, which is that, okay, the Republicans are going to call us crazy socialists, so we might as well, I don't know, support crazy socialist ideas. Like, wait, no, that's not the right answer. Whatever the Republicans are going to say about us, let's make sure that, we are responsible. And if they're lying about us, let's call them out for lying about us. Let's have that moment where we go, well, there you go again. You know, we are not. They're saying these nutty things about us when clearly we are not. The danger is basically falling into the, you know, allowing your other side to be able to, you know, push you into the corner. Which, by the way, the reason I'm saying this is because I saw this happen on the right and on this issue of race. For 20 or 30 years, every conservative was constantly being accused of being a racist, right? Mitt Romney was a racist. John McCain was a racist. George H.W. Bush was a racist. Everybody was a racist. So at a certain point, what happened was people said, well, look, whatever we do, they're going to call us racist. So we might as well be racist. We might as well elect Donald Trump. We might as well refer to people as cockroaches and vermin and rapists and all of that stuff.
That is like that idea that if we call them Nazis, they'll be Nazis. Like, maybe there's some blowback, you know, I really think there's a lot of power in calling things by their names. You know, and I understand, yes, that there's like, there are certain things that happen in campaigns that aren't useful. Like, a basket of deplorables is a great example. But I also think, like, if you think about, the thing I often think about is after the stuff with Access Hollywood came out, there were women wearing shirts that said Trump can grab my and an air. But it's this idea of like some of this emboldenedness isn't from calling things by their name. It's some kind of innate thing that is deeper in the culture. you know, there are Democrats are going to do things that Republicans aren't going to love. And, you know, never Trumpers are going to have a conflict of whether or not they're going to want to go along with it. But at the end of the day, you know, it's going to be the difference between expanding Medicare. Listen, I personally, I have, you know, I'm liberal, but I'm actually ultimately not as liberal as a lot of people. But, you know, Republicans have to decide if they're going to go along with some, you know, some Democratic plans, which probably are not going to be able to be enacted. I mean, we know how Congress works. Or, you know, if they're going to continue with Trumpism. And it's like, it's a pretty stark contrast, ultimately.
It's a very stark contrast. Well, we've been talking about the way this, the race issues in Charlottesville and all of this plays out with the Republican base. But, you know, obviously, I'm sensing that Republicans are also deeply uneasy because they really do know that even though this may strengthen support for Trump and the hardcore Trump base, that they are really sowing a whirlwind when it comes to moderates, centrists, female voters, suburban voters. And the question is whether the disgust over the president's treatment of these issues is enough to override what might be some of these more, you know, economic questions that you were just raising.
And I'm also, I mean, ultimately, this election is going to come down to six states, right? It's going to be like 100,000 people in six states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida. So that's going to look totally different. But the larger topography of what happens with this white nationalism, which has really been, you know, it's a Pandora's box. When that closes, how we close that, I don't know.
So how are you feeling right now about the Democratic race? I know you were early in for Mayor Pete. So when you crazy socialist hate America lefties get together in your, you know, elite Georgetown parties, what do you say to one another about how this is going?
So I really like Mayor Pete, but I also really like Warren a lot. I have a real place in my heart for Elizabeth Warren, and a lot of women do. Now, I don't know that that means she'll be the nominee, but I do think there are a lot of women who feel like I do, which is that we had a very capable woman who maybe people didn't love, but who was very capable. And she was beaten by this like absolutely atrocious reality television host. And now we have this woman who is very progressive, but she's also very thoughtful. My husband really, really, really is not a fan of hers, but I really like adore her. And so I don't know. I love Warren. I really like Mayor Pete. I see them as, you know, I would be fine with Biden.
You'd be fine with Grandpa Joe.
Yeah, Uncle Joe, creepy Uncle Joe. I'd be fine with that.
Oh, okay. Listen, I think I said this in the podcast. Look, I'm almost certainly wrong about this, and I did bring this up on the podcast last week. And the more I think about it, I'm certainly wrong because I'm wrong about this stuff all the time. But I noticed that the media is buying into this narrative that he's gaffe prone, and this is going to be a big problem because he gets things wrong. And I'm thinking, no, we kind of knew that about Uncle Joe. I mean, this is the media, you know, going into its, you know, hive mind about all of this, and I just don't think any of them have been that horrible. But
I also think with Joe Biden, the way that Joe Biden wins, if he's the nominee, which he very well might be, is he's so, everything Trump does, Joe Biden, like everything that you could say is problematic about Joe Biden, Trump does a million times worse. So you see what I'm, so like Joe Biden makes a gaffe, Trump makes a, you know, a 10 million times worse gaffe. Joe Biden kisses someone in a weird way. Trump is molesting people, you know, so it happens to be that he's going to have a hard time. You know, Junior's tweeting mean things about Joe Biden's kid. Junior has five kids and left his wife and had an affair. I mean, with him, you know, forget it. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Okay, so what's your take on the mooch? Anthony Scaramucci.
I'm
going to go all the things that happened over the weekend. Here's Trump's Twitter. Retweets conspiracy theories about Jeffrey Epstein, attacks the media, praises Kim Jong-un, attacks the U.S.-South Korea military exercises, attacks Bill Maher, accuses China of wanting a Democrat in 2020, attacks Joe Biden, and then at the bottom, attacks Scaramucci. So let's talk about Scaramucci.
And also, Bill, and also our friend from Bloomberg.
Oh.
Tim O'Brien.
Tim O'Brien, yeah.
No, and Maggie Haberman.
Wait, they wear that as a badge of honor. That's almost old stuff now. But yeah. but Scaramucci, who was White House communications director for about 4.5 minutes.
Yeah.
He's out.
I cannot get less of him. I would like to get less of him than I'm getting now. I think he is like the worst opportunist there is. I think he has no intellect, he's completely irrelevant. He's like Omarosa without the.
I thought I was the only one. I'm thinking, why are we paying attention to this shill? I mean, it was like, again, it was as recently as May. He's basically going on television, sucking up to Donald Trump, saying, oh, I want my old job back. I will do and say anything. Okay, in May. What did you not know that you know now? I mean, May.
He learned that he's not getting the job back.
Well, that's right. So are we now obligated to take Scaramucci seriously? Because I'm a serious hard no on that.
And welcome Scaramucci to the resistance? No. Personally, I don't think there's any, it's one thing to be a never Trumper. It's another thing to just decide that it's more, it's better for your career to oppose Trumpism now so late in the game. Forget it.
Yeah. Okay. So we need to get to the Jeffrey Epstein thing. I thought Charlie Wardzell had a great piece in the New York Times where he basically talks about this as the worst case scenario. A grim testament to our deeply poisoned information ecosystem. One that's built for speed and designed to reward the most incendiary impulses of its worst actors. It has ushered in a parallel reality unrooted in fact and helped to push conspiratorial thinking into the cultural mainstream. And with each news cycle, the system grows more efficient, entrenching its opposing camps. The poison spreads. But this is like, but the problem with Jeffrey Epstein is, it does stink, doesn't it?
No, I think
American
it's American jails stink. Mm. I mean, sorry to interrupt you, but I just think, I think the Post, which is supposedly the intellectual hub of pro-Trumpism, had a op-ed about how journalists were not being conspiratorial enough about Epstein. I think the American jails are terrible. I was talking to my husband about this yesterday, and I was like, think about LaGuardia Airport, right? Which is not even meant to punish people, right? Like, the city is not good at stuff like this.
Okay, how'd you get to LaGuardia Airport from...
Well, because
you want to kill yourself when you go to the airport?
I'm just saying that if you think about, the Metropolitan Correctional Center, not taking good care of its prisoners.
They're just bad at stuff, you're saying.
Right, they're bad at stuff. I mean, you go to LaGuardia Airport, nobody's, you're not being held there, but you wouldn't know it.
See, I don't mind LaGuardia that much. I don't know. As long as I get there, because the construction is so... But your mayor, Bill de Blasio, I mean, this guy's a rock star.
Wait, what?
I kid. Yeah. Actually, one of the best stories you've written for The Bulwark, and there are many, was your takedown of Bill de Blasio and what an absurd idea it was that a guy that actually, killed the... Who did he kill? What was his name?
Groundhog. I can't remember his name.
He killed... This is a mayor who kills Groundhog on Groundhog Day, and he thinks he ought to be president.
Yeah, I mean, he is really... He's so terrible, and he's a really bad mayor. And it's interesting because there are a lot. He has a lot of very woke liberal ideas, that some of which I really like, and some of which I don't. What's interesting about him, I always find, is he says all the communist stuff out loud, like all the stuff that even Bernie knows not to say. Like, brothers and sisters, grab your sickles. Like, we're going to redistribute the wealth. Like, we're going to have people living in, we're going to have homeless people living in living rooms on Fifth Avenue. Everyone knows not to say that except Bill de Blasio.
Well, okay, they know not to say it, but I mean, are you saying they think it, but they know not to say it?
I'm saying it doesn't matter because it will never be enacted because the government doesn't, you know, the Congress will never allow it. But and I don't think they ultimately support it, but they know enough that that is stuff that people really don't like to hear. And Bill de Blasio is just all in on it. He quoted Che Guevara.
Yeah, Che's big. Yeah, Che's big where right now? I mean,
not big anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, that's a dog whistle to a base that. Well, let's just put it that way. That
very
is not
small
that
base.
Okay, did you watch, by the way, the video of the Democratic Socialists of America convention?
I didn't see it.
Oh, you have to see it. Let me just say, I am relatively confident in predicting that they will not become the vanguard of the proletariat, particularly in Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania anytime soon.
I didn't see it, but I did see Colette's fake DSA piece.
Ooh, that was bad.
That was bad. I mean, that was bad.
Yeah, life lesson bad. When somebody you've never heard of sends you an article to publish, have some due diligence.
Yes, mistake. God.
So how many people, Molly, you must work all the time. I mean, I follow you on Twitter and you're like, hey, here's my piece in Glamour. Here's my piece in Playboy. And here's my piece on, you know, Ladies Home Journal. And there's my piece. I'm like, I mean, you write for a lot of people, don't you? I mean, you're just like sitting there churning stuff out.
I'm actually, because Rick and I did a piece this weekend for the Daily Beast, and he's
Rick Wilson.
Yeah. And we were doing it on Google Docs. And he is a much, 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 much faster writer than I am. And I was shocked because I'm actually really slow. Yeah, I would say I do like 3 or 4 pieces a week. But I am, I don't know. You know, I have a lot of stuff. I had a slow week last week where I was sort of a little bit.
It's August. It is August. You're allowed.
But I do think, but you know, it's fun for me. And I really love all my venues sort of work out for me. Like for the Bulwark, I can do like these takedown pieces, which I love to do and are really fun about people and their larger implication in the Trump world. And they're interesting and they can be sort of funny and weird. And JVL is, Jonathan Lass is really good editor. He is.
Okay, I want to have you make a prediction. Right after this, we have to hear a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high-growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder, how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do? And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup. Only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first 2 batches, so they're going fast. For a limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's EIGHTsleep.com/bulwark. All right, we're back with Molly Jong Fast. All right, quick predictions, because we don't usually have an opportunity to speak to people who are as deep in the belly of Democratic politics as you. Well, is that a fair way? Progressive politics, or, you know, progressive but not crazy politics? How do you want to describe yourself?
I'm less now because I've gotten increasingly uncomfortable. I'm increasingly uncomfortable making donations to political candidates. So I'm sort of out of it a little bit, but yeah, I see a lot of stuff.
Okay. So who's going to be the nominee?
So last week I was convinced it was going to be Biden. Because he just isn't slipping enough. And if you look at the numbers, like this time in the Republican cycle, Trump was already the nominee. I think it's probably going to be Biden. I have a fantasy scenario where it's Warren and Buttigieg together. I could see, I hope that if it is Biden, that he picks a VP, that he doesn't pull a Hillary and just picks some white guy he likes. You know, that he really picks someone who is, you know, from the more progressive side of the party, and who is either a woman or African American, and who really speaks to that. It doesn't have to be, you know, or, I mean, I even think, you know, Mayor Pete might be okay, where he picks someone who can speak to the left of the party too, because it's a big tent party for a reason.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to imagine two white guys being on the ticket again. I mean, it's gonna be painful enough. If you have, you know, two 70-year-old guys up against one another, and I say that as somebody's willing to cut people some slack on age, but I mean, really, people.
It's just interesting to me because we're in a, you know, we don't see. I mean, I was watching that second round of debates, and I was thinking to myself, there is so much misogyny cooked in to this situation, and I have this theory that Democrats are so afraid. I mean, this is like everyone says this. Democrats are really, and I've seen this anecdotally, Democrats are really, really, really afraid of losing to Trump again. So all they really want.
Well, they ought to be.
Right. And all they really want in a candidate is someone who can beat Trump. Really. And you talk to people. I mean, you know, on Twitter, you'll see people have nuanced views of Medicare for All. But if you get out there, largely people just want someone who will beat Trump. And the question is, I think the question is, what does that look like? And I think a lot of Democrats have decided, and they can't say it out loud and they don't want to because it's not who they are, but they've decided that one of the reasons why Hillary lost was because she was a woman. And so that's why I think it's very unlikely we're going to have a woman candidate.
Even though you like Elizabeth Warren. So why does your husband not like her?
Because, you know, he's a venture capitalist.
Oh, and
regulation.
And she hates capitalism, so.
Well, she doesn't hate capitalism.
She wants to save capitalism, right?
She wants to regulate capitalism, which is, you know, it's funny because there's a lot of, as a Democrat, there's a lot of good regulation in my mind, like environmental regulation. But I've seen a lot of really dumb financial regulation.
Well, yes, there's I should send you my copy of Hayek. He said, I don't know, you could share it. We could, you know, sit around. So, I had this conversation yesterday with some people. Maybe you can shed some light on it because when we were talking about Bill de Blasio, you said he takes all kinds of, you know, woke positions.
Yeah.
Is woke a term that people still use earnestly, or has it already become ironic?
I think that, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a little bit ironic, but, you know, all of the far left, mid left, all of our culture, all of the humor in politics has become very ironic. So, you know, it's hard to say what's ironic and what's real non-ironic. We're in the post-irony world.
Yeah, no, it is hard. It's people say, well, this person is woke. Okay, are you being like really earnest? I mean, it's at the DSA convention where, you know, they're doing all the jazz hands and stuff. I mean, there was no irony there whatsoever. I mean, that's the thing. You can just tell. No irony, no humor, no, you know, it's like, you know, you will be made, you know, that's not funny and you will be made to care. But I don't see them as part of the mainstream.
I mean, I think also there is a lot of like irony, though. If you listen to those guys in Chapo, like there's ironic wokeism. I mean, I don't know I don't totally understand exactly what it is, but that's, you know, you do see that.
Ironic wokeism, which would be different than performative wokeism, but we'll do this some other time. Molly Jong-Fast, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate
thank
it very,
you for
very
having
much.
Me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's podcast was brought to you by our friends at 8 Sleep. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.